Over the last 30 years, I have presided at a lot of weddings. And when I was an associate pastor, a lot of the weddings that I did were for people I had never met before. During the offering time, girls, sorry, I didn't give all my instructions. So a lot of the weddings that I did when I was an associate pastor were for people that I didn't know. And they would call up the church and they would have heard that we were willing to do non-member weddings and that there was it was a pretty building, and so they would ask if they could get married at our church. And for the most part, I, you know, was happy to do that. And then my duties would be to do the pastoral counseling, to do the rehearsal, and to the wedding, and then I was done. And a lot of times that meant as soon as the wedding was over, I would never see these people ever again, which was okay with me. The church, I went into it willingly, knowing that we were doing something for folks who might not come back to our congregation. Sometimes, though, things would be different. Every so often, there would be a connection, or a couple would be looking for a new church home, and they would stick around. And so, one time, we were invited to come to the wedding of the Ravellos. Now, when you're the pastor at a wedding and you are invited, you are most typically seated with the grandparents, the great-grandparents, or maybe second cousins. It's family people. It's people they figure will not say something weird in front of the pastor, and that's where I always end up. At the Ravellos' wedding, at Chris and Walt's wedding, we ended up sitting with the grandparents, but we also were sitting with the bride's dad and with his partner. And it was one of those full sit-down meals. There were lots of things on the table, and there were plates and butter plates and coffee cups and three kinds of stemware to have all the right things to drink in, and lots of silverware. Matt, my husband, was seated next to Ken, who was the father of the bride. And when the rolls were passed around, Matt took a roll and he put it on the bread plate to the right of his plate. Began buttering his bread. He was happy eating his bread. A few minutes later, Ken, father of the bride, says, "Excuse me, could I have that bread plate, the one that was on Matt's left?" And so Matt handed it to him, and Matt just kind of, "Ha ha, that's weird." So then, a little bit later, they came around, they served the salad. And Matt started eating right away, and when Ken asked him if he could have that fork to Matt's left, Matt handed him the fork. And then he made a joke about whether or not the servers realized that the father of the bride hadn't gotten a bread plate or enough silverware. For those of you who have set fancy tables, my husband was using the plate and the silverware that belonged to the father of the bride. I wasn't paying close enough attention. Katie was 8. I was watching out for her. And so I didn't realize all of this was going on. And so then when my husband told me, "Gosh, that was strange, you know, father bride doesn't have enough silverware, doesn't have the plate. I mean, you would think they would have treated him better." I wanted to crawl under the table and cry. It was just like, oh, gosh. The good news is that the bride and the groom became members of our congregation, and every time Ken came to visit his daughter, he and Matt would have a good laugh about forks and bread plates. And I got permission to tell this story, and if you ask Matt, he would tell it to you himself. And I think he now knows that when you sit at a dinner, the forks that are yours are on the left, along with the bread plate. And if there's a spoon at the top, like this above the plate, that means there's dessert. So always look for that spoon. I get excited when there's a spoon. It means there's dessert. In today's gospel, Jesus had been invited to a banquet. And it's not the first time in the Gospel of Luke that a Pharisee invited Jesus to dinner. It's actually the third time. And although we think of the Pharisees as being the opposition, that wasn't always the case. There was a certain collegial relationship that meant that the Pharisees might be willing to invite this notable teacher to come and be a part of their meal, to come and to be observed, but also to debate and discuss the things that might be going on in their lives. Since Pharisees were pretty well paid, it's pretty likely that this dinner that Jesus came to was one of those fancy ones with a long table, lots of silverware, things to get confused by about which dish was yours, and those little bowls they bring with the water. What are those for? You know, all that kind of stuff, the way they did it then. So really busy, really full, really fancy. And while the locals were watching Jesus, he was watching them. And the guests all seemed to be jockeying to get the best seats at the table, which was the norm in Greco-Roman society. Meals were a time when you would see what your social ranking was. It was very important, and people would notice whether or not by where you were seated had you moved up or down the social ladder. Banquets were a time when it was very obvious who was your peer, who were your betters, and who was beneath you. Ancient libraries were apparently full of books on etiquette and how to behave when out and about. And one of the Jewish books, the Book of Sirach, gives lots of advice about how to act at meals, including warnings against being greedy. It says, when you go to a banquet, do not say, how much food is there? I think that's good advice. Don't ask how much food there is at the party. Do not reach out your hand for everything you see, and do not crowd your neighbor at the dish. Eat what is set before you like a well-brought-up person, and do not chew greedily or you will give offense. If you are seated among many persons, do not help yourself before they do. While this kind of advice would have been in the minds of some of those who were at the dinner that day, Jesus goes even further in warning them against seeking out the most honorable seats. He tells those who are gathered that they should pursue humility, which was very, very rarely considered a virtue in society at that time. It wasn't seen as being important. It wasn't something people talked about. It wasn't a significant idea, humility among your peers. And yet it was to be the hallmark of those who were to be disciples of Jesus in that time and in this. It comes up again and again in the New Testament that we are to live lives of humility. It's in Luke, Philippians, Colossians, in the book of James, and in the first letter of Peter. That's who Christians are supposed to be. But Jesus didn't scold the guests that day. He doesn't shame them and say, how dare you worry about where to sit? In fact, he assumes that this question is a part of their daily lives, that this is something that is just going to happen. But what he does want to talk about is who has the highest or lowest seat, and how do you navigate that kind of social event? Really, nothing has changed. The best seat is where we all want to be if we're honest with ourselves. I have a friend who, when we would go to a restaurant and we come in, she always has to have the seat facing the door, always. Has to have that seat. One time we went to a restaurant and she went to the ladies' room, and so I thought, I'm going to sit where I want to sit. And so I sat in the seat, which should have been hers, facing the door. And when she came out, she said, either I'm going to sit next to you or you're going to move. Which is it? I moved. She's that kind of friend. She always tells me it's her army training, and so she's protecting me from whatever might come into the restaurant because she can see the door, and she'll ask me, do I have any military training? I don't, so then I have to move and sit with my back to the door. But I know she is taking the best seat, and I suspect that it's really not about protecting me because ninja warriors have never come into a restaurant when we were eating dinner. She likes to sit there. When we pick the seat, we are thinking about our own comfort, our safety, our pleasure, and how it is that we might control those things. You go to a meeting, you always think about where you sit. You don't sit in the president's chair, and you know where the president's chair is. I know where Gary sits at council meetings. I never sit in that chair. I sit right next to him, you know. Good advice to pay attention to those kinds of things, and good advice from Jesus to pay attention to how we make those decisions, to try and think about ourselves after we've thought about everyone else. It's good advice when you go to a party. But Jesus wasn't just offering rules for etiquette. What he was trying to teach all of us is a way of being that will shape our entire lives. And he wants us to be especially aware of those times when we make those choices as if having the best seat was the most important thing of the day. That it's something we need to do. That we need to place ourselves in positions of power or authority or in positions that are comfortable or make us have a joyful feeling. We are to think about why we are making those choices. He also wants to make sure that we include everyone at the table. Rather than limiting our guest list to people who are just like us, to people with whom we'd be comfortable, who don't threaten us, who don't even challenge us, we are called to invite those who are different. Maybe those people who do make us uncomfortable, because they might be a blessing, and we won't know until we ask them to be at our table. The banquet table is a metaphor for our entire lives. Jesus calls us to think less of ourselves and to think more about others. Yesterday, I read a Facebook post that said, Jesus thought there were only two kinds of people. There were your friends, who we are to love, and there are your enemies, who we are to love. Jesus didn't just tell us how to give of ourselves and how to love our neighbors and love our enemies. He demonstrated it every day of his life. All the stories we've heard again and again all point to this idea. His ministry, his death, and his resurrection are all about somebody else, not about him. Over and over, he takes the worst seat at the table. He puts himself in uncomfortable situations for the sake of other people. There is never a question of leaving anyone out. No matter their background or their story or their station in life, Jesus loved each person he met, and he gave his life for us all. Earlier this week, I read a story about a congregation that had been prevented from serving breakfast to the needy in their community. They were going to serve breakfast in a local park, and the police came and said, you can't do that. And so they had to follow the cease and desist order and fortunately found a church parking lot a couple blocks away, and everybody just took the festival to that place. It reminded me of a similar story that happened in 2013, and you may have even seen it on the news. My friend Hugh Hollowell, for many years, was the minister at Love Wins Ministries in Raleigh, North Carolina. Love Wins serves the homeless community of Raleigh in a variety of ways. They will tell you there is always bread and peanut butter and jelly to be had if you come to their offices. They also have had a tradition which has now changed a little bit, but in 2013, what they had been doing for 6 years was they would come to a park in the inner city area where a lot of homeless people were, and they would serve them breakfast. One Saturday, all the volunteers showed up at 9 o'clock, just like they had done virtually every weekend for 6 years, and they provided, without cost or obligation, a sausage breakfast sandwich and a cup of coffee to anyone who came up and asked. And they did this work in cooperation with 5 different suburban churches who would buy and make all of the food and come and volunteer. But on that Saturday, things were different. 3 officers from the Raleigh Police Department prevented them from doing their work. An officer said quite bluntly that if they attempted to distribute the food, they were going to be arrested. They had brought 100 sausage biscuits and a whole lot of coffee with them. And so Hugh asked the officers for permission. Could they please share the food? There were like 70 people in this park who were hungry, who were counting on them for food for the day. But the police said, no, you can't. And so Hugh had to turn away these hungry people who were waiting and tell them that he couldn't feed them because if he did, he would be arrested. Nobody from the Raleigh Police Department that day was willing to tell the people from Love Wins why it was that they couldn't serve food. They couldn't explain what was the ordinance they had broke, what was the rule that they were breaking. And so after 6 years, with countless friendly interactions between the police and Love Wins, they weren't able to serve breakfast. They were unable to fulfill their promise to feed the poor of Raleigh. In the days that followed, Hugh Hollowell, his colleagues, and volunteers spread the story through blogs and Facebook posts and other social media. Their story was picked up by a local radio station and TV stations and newspapers in the area, and after 8 days, they hit Good Morning America, and there was Hugh telling the story. At one point, it seemed that the mayor of Raleigh was going to continue to prevent Love Wins from feeding people. But after a 2.5-hour meeting of the church of the city council, it was ultimately agreed that the city would not enforce an ordinance that prohibited the sharing of food with people in public places. There's a law against that. Love Wins and its partnering churches were able to continue to make up the gap in social services that usually were taken care of by the city. There were local government institutions that fed the people Monday through Friday, but there wasn't anything to eat on Saturday and Sunday. So after they relaxed the rules, they were able to feed people again. Jesus calls us to step away from the comfortable seat at the banquet, to feed and to show hospitality to each child of God, no matter who they are, no matter where they are, and if there are challenges, if someone says, no, you can't do that, Jesus calls us to keep following his path, living a life of faith, and sharing what we have with other people. Lutheran writer Walt Wangerin said, this is the acid test for caring for our brothers and sisters. He says, do you love Christ Jesus? This question embraces the next one. Do you love the real manifestations of Christ in the world around you? In other words, the people of God, do you love them? And then the question which makes the sharpest and purest of points is this: how do you love the ones you do not meet, who cannot punish or reward you, blame or praise you, or in any way make the action anything more than the unvarnished, spontaneous revelation of your natural self? We are called to love without regard for how it impacts us, without knowing what the results are, without knowing who we're helping. We are called to be of service. The writer to the Hebrews gives great advice on how to do that and reminds us that God has said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you, I will always be by your side. And because of that promise, we are bold enough to say, God is my help, I'm not going to be afraid of anything. No one can harm me because God is with me. We are always playing with a safety net, even when it feels like the things that we are called to do might be a little bit dangerous or maybe a little bit more than we thought we were willing to give. We are playing with the security of knowing that God is with us. We are safe. We have been redeemed. And so in that safety, in that redemption, in that love, we are called to share, knowing that Jesus' love is a constant, Jesus' strength is a gift, and Jesus has always been with us yesterday, tomorrow, today, the next week, forever. God's love is with us. And so we go out to share the good news and to share it not just with our words, but in the things that we do. Not worrying about where we get to sit at the table. It doesn't matter. We may not even get a chair. But as long as we are serving the people of God, we're in the right place.